It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent. And the Milwaukee Brewers open their new season this afternoon in Queens against the New York Mets. First pitch, 12:40. The Brewers' home opener is next Tuesday afternoon against the Minnesota Twins. What are your expectations for this year for a team that has made it to the postseason in five of the last 6 years? Can they do it again? What do you think? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is J.R. Radcliffe, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And J.R., welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, great to be here again. Thanks.
Yeah, big changes for this team this year. As I saw last night, about a dozen new faces on the opening day roster for the Milwaukee Brewers. But JR, perhaps arguably the biggest change for this team wasn't on the field, but was rather their manager. The manager that's taken them to the postseason for five of the last 6 years, Craig Counsell, has moved to division rival the Chicago Cubs. What do the Brewers lose in Craig Counsell, and what do they gain in Pat Murphy, their new manager?
Yeah, I imagine there were a few Brewers fans paying attention to last night's game between the defending champion Texas Rangers and Chicago Cubs. The Rangers came back to win by one run, which...
extra innings?
Extra innings. As I'm sure many people point out, Counsell has been hailed for his great record in one-run games. So just a tiny bit of irony in the teeny tiny sample of the season opener. But yeah, this is a new era for a number of reasons, and that's a big one. Pat Murphy is a guy who has worked closely with Craig Counsell for a long time. He was the coach at Notre Dame when Craig Counsell was a player there. They had worked together a long time with the Brewers, especially, and you know, so it's probably not really skipping much of a beat in terms of continuity inside the clubhouse. Many of the same coaches are back, and it's going to be a pretty similar vibe. Other than the guy at the top, he's just going to have a different outward personality working with the media. He's much more gregarious. He's going to have some good one-liners. He's just kind of an interesting, you know, different energy. But I don't think that really changes inside the clubhouse. Now, what they're losing, though, is a great tactician in Craig Counsell, who has, you know, if managers, I don't think, make as much a difference as a lot of people think they do. But if there are any differences to be had, I think Craig Counsell kind of squeezed, you know, he was able to get everything out of the Milwaukee Brewers. He was able to kind of get all those things on the fringe and create an advantage out of it. So he's a guy, you know, taking that skill somewhere else to a division rival and a team that's probably going to be favored to win that division to make it hurt even worse. Oh. I think the Chicago Cubs are the team to beat this year.
Wow, JR. The other big change, and I noticed this yesterday, the opening day pitcher for the Milwaukee Brewers the last couple of seasons was pitching on opening day for the Baltimore Orioles yesterday. Corbin Burnes gave up a home run to Mike Trout in the first inning, but after that he was pretty much lights out. And this was a trade that took place right before spring training. JR Radcliffe, let me ask you what I think a lot of Brewers fans were asking when this trade took place. What? Why?
Yeah, and there are still some people who are going to wonder that. Corbin Burnes was fantastic in his debut for the Orioles, as you mentioned. He was going to be a free agent after this season.
Okay. This
was going to be, in any scenario, the last season of Corbin Burnes as a Milwaukee Brewer. They felt the best way to maximize, you know, what they were able to work with was to trade him now, give whatever team a season of Corbin Burnes and get a couple players back in exchange. And the two guys they got back are going to be key contributors. Joey Ortiz, a very young shortstop, third base type, who's probably going to play third base for the Brewers. And then as well, DL Hall, who is going to be a key member of the pitching rotation, a left-hander, very exciting young player. You know, there's pros and cons to his game as he's been coming up. He doesn't have elite pinpoint control, but the Brewers are working on that. And, you know, I think in the short term, that's a net loss because you're taking away one of the best pitchers in baseball. The Brewers hope in the long term, they gain several years of pretty quality players, even if it means sacrificing a really good year, a great year from a great player.
We're talking about predictions for the Milwaukee Brewers seasons with J.R. Radcliffe from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you're planning to go out to the old ball game this summer and hit up American Family Field and have the experience, let us know what you love about it. 800-642-1234. And if there is another storyline for the Brewers opening day later this afternoon, 12:40, first pitch, our time, I would say it has to be the injuries that the Brewers start the season with, JR.
Yeah, they've had a few of them. Wade Miley, who's going to be a big part of their rotation, he's going to be on the shelf for a short period of time. We'll probably just miss the first couple weeks, which isn't a huge deal for a starting pitcher, but still, that's not nothing. They don't have a lot of frontline starting pitchers this year, so that's a pretty big loss. But a couple of the bigger ones include their closer, Devin Williams, who's out for 3 months with some fractures in his back, and he's one of the truly special players on this team. He's probably one of the things that you would say, what makes the Brewers special? Devin Williams would be on that list. And he was the reliever of the year in the National League last year. Not having that just incredible force to close down games is going to have a pretty big ripple effect on this bullpen and on this pitching staff as a whole. And then Garrett Mitchell, just a few days before the season started, was going to be their starting center fielder. He ends up with a broken finger. So he's going to be out for probably a couple months, and that causes some juggling, some dominoes. I think they have the depth to overcome a loss like Garrett Mitchell, but that's, obviously one more thing. And there's a couple other guys too that they were potentially counting on that are going to start the year on the sidelines. So every team goes through that. It's not completely unusual, but yes, the Brewers certainly did not emerge from spring training unscathed.
And I would say the biggest addition in the offseason for the Brewers roster would have to be Rhys Hoskins, a big bat that has played had played for the Philadelphia Phillies for a few years. What does Rhys bring to the Brewers this season, JR?
I mean, he brings power. The Brewers have really had trouble filling the first base position. We all remember Prince Fielder, and since then, it's kind of been a revolving door of first basemen, and they've had success here and there, but for the most part, they haven't had that just true thumper in the middle of the lineup who plays first base. And Rhys Hoskins can do that. Now there's a little bit of risk. He missed all of last season with an ACL tear. So, he hasn't played in a while. It doesn't look like that's going to hold him back necessarily, but that's just something, a bit of caution. He's in his 30s. So, but he was the best first baseman on the market. The Brewers going after him actually kind of isn't typical behavior from them, going after the guy at a position of need who's best, the best available dude. That doing that was interesting. So, in general, this Brewers lineup is going to be the one that has to carry them. In the past few years, it's been all about that pitching staff. Well, they don't have Corbin Burns anymore. They don't have Brandon Woodruff, who was such a key contributor as well the last few years. Excellent pitcher who's injured this year, did resign, but is going to miss the full season. So it's going to be incumbent on the offense to score a lot more runs than they have the last few years. And they have some of the pieces that could probably do that. I don't know if it's enough to overcome the losses in the pitching department, but it's going to be a little bit of a different look.
Yeah, it's a little bit of different expectations for this team that we're used to making the postseason. And JR, this year, it seems like it could be an uphill climb. You said that the division rival Chicago Cubs are the favorite to win out the division this season. Where do you put the expectations for the Brewers as we go through the summer?
There are challenges for sure. They won 92 games last year, kind of ran away with the division. If you would think that if they subtract from the pitching staff and add to the lineup, maybe that would balance out a little bit. But I don't think that's what's going to happen. I mean, I would say that I'm pretty pessimistic about how they're going to do this year. I think they're a 500 team at best. Maybe 82 wins, 83. The way that baseball works now, that's not even completely out of the playoff race.
Right.
There is a chance if they maximize that and get to, say, 86, 87 wins, then they are absolutely going to be in the mix for a playoff spot. So that's not necessarily a dire prediction, but I think they're taking a huge step back. I think there's an opportunity for them to be really good next season in 2025 with some of the young players they have. That doesn't mean these guys aren't going to, rise to the occasion this year. Some of the guys that people aren't counting on might maybe have great seasons. Like
Right.
it is definitely there is a wide range of outcomes here.
This
I
is,
just right now don't see it on
but
paper.
this is a lot of what I love about the opening day of Major League Baseball. And I say this growing up with a Cubs fan who is, hope springs eternal until after the first day of baseball, and then it's like the season's over. But if you have a team like this where the expectations are so low and they exceed those expectations and you get closer and closer to the postseason, it feels like something special. That storyline becomes much bigger than if you enter the season as the Brewers formerly had, with the expectations that they'll be there come the postseason. This team doesn't have those expectations this year, which means if we get closer to it and they get closer to it, it'll be a heck of a story for sports throughout baseball.
I would point back to the 2018 season for the Brewers to fit exactly what you're describing. That was a team built kind of similarly. relying on its offense, not a ton of frontline starting pitchers. They went all the way to game seven of the NLCS. It was a thrilling ride
Yes.
for Milwaukee fans. Built a little bit like that, maybe not quite as good because they've been to the playoffs in recent years, so it would be seen as a step back to kind of not be at the forefront of that conversation. But still, you're right. I mean, look at the Packers last year. How great of a ride that was because they outperformed the expectations that were laid out for them.
Exactly. J.R. Ratcliffe, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll get to your calls next at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
On the Ideas Network, you're invited to be part of the conversation. When you call our talk shows, you play an important role. If you have a question or comment, we want to hear it. Be part of the conversation and check out our caller guidelines at wpr.org/guidelines.
Still to come on The Morning Show, a preview of this season's new look, Milwaukee Brewers. We'll also take the 8 o'clock hour to help millennials build their financial security with the founder of Millennial Money.
Support for WPR comes from the Commonweal Theater and TDS Custom Construction. Your business or organization can partner in providing the WPR programs that enrich our communities. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
Put WPR in your pocket with the WPR app for Android or Apple phones. Get the latest news, stream WPR live, and hear programs when you want them. Download it at the Google Play Store or on the iTunes App Store. WPR is everywhere.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and with their first game of the season later this afternoon, we're talking Brewers baseball with our guest, J.R. Ratcliffe, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we invite you to the conversation, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Mike and Franklin, good morning. What do you think of our Brewers this year?
Well, I'm really excited for the season like we are every year. And we are very, very fortunate to be in a community where everybody is very, very fanatic about sports around here. But I think one thing that, and you started to talk about it, there have been seasons where there have been teams that have won over 100 games during the season, and then they flame out in the postseason. And you mentioned the 2018 when the Brewers had a team very much like they're going to have this year. And they managed to make the playoffs, and then who knows what's going to happen after that. So I think if we're just patient, it's a long season. Mm-hmm. Keep everybody healthy, make the playoffs. We got a really, really good chance of winning it all. So I think if the fans in the area can still go kind of like let's win two out of three on a home series and half on the road, and just kind of play that statistic, we got a really good chance of winning it all.
Hey, Mike, I appreciate the call, and it's a little bit of a contrast from JR call saying the division this year that the Brewers are in is likely to have the Cubs at the top at the end of the season, but there are some real bright spots here for these Milwaukee Brewers, and some of them are very young. JR, Jackson Churio, set to make history as the youngest Milwaukee Brewer player since Robin Yount in 1974 to make their MLB debut with the Brewers today. He signed the largest contract made to a player before making their MLB debut, coming out to an 8-year, $82 million deal. Why is there so much excitement behind this young player that is yet to play in the bigs?
Yeah, there's a good possibility that he's going to be a superstar. You know, he's trending that way. Now, he's only 20 years old. There isn't a ton of data on him yet because he hasn't been playing professional baseball that long. But he has thrived at every level he's been at. He's risen to be one of the top two, maybe three, but more likely top two prospects in all of baseball. And the Brewers have not had a guy at that level. They just haven't had that. They've been close. They've had some guys in the top 10, top 15 in all of baseball, but nothing like this. So he's a guy who signed out of Venezuela, and is you know, the Brewers are really dreaming on him being an incredible baseball player pretty quickly. You know, he'll struggle unquestionably in his first year
Yeah,
on the
what did we
job,
see
like you
in spring
mentioned.
training from him, JR? That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah, a mixed bag. I mean,
Okay.
I think defensively there's a ways to go. I think they visualize him as a center fielder. He's not there yet. He's going to be playing right field. And you know, up and down, but we saw that in the minors too. There were brief periods, as there are for every player, where he was not at that level, that superstar level, and then he adjusted, and then he became just an impossible guy to get out. So there's going to be a learning curve, unquestionably. But I think, you know, by June, you might even by then, you might see some pretty big developments there. So very exciting time. It's going to be a project in the beginning, but I think the question is how long it's going to be a project, and I bet they think it's not going to be for very long.
Watch that young man in right field this season. We go back to your calls at 1-800-642-1234. Melissa and Madison, good morning.
Hi.
Hi, what do you have for us?
So I'm kind of a newer baseball fan. I went to my first game 2 years ago, I think it was, and now live games just make such a difference for me. It's so much fun. And I'm excited for this season. We've had some really good seasons in the past, so ever hopeful, like the other caller said, ever hopeful. And just a plug for Quick Trip. They have a mobile app that's giving away free Brewer tickets. I've already scored two for the season, and all you have to do is spend money we're going to spend anyways.
So you can get free tickets from the app and go to American Family Field this summer?
Yeah.
I very much appreciate that, Melissa. Thank you. If you're looking to make it out to the old ballpark. And if you can't make it out to the old ballpark, with the home opener on Tuesday against the Minnesota Twins Tuesday afternoon, there is one person returning, the man who has been there since 1971. 90-year-old Bob Uecker will be doing the play-by-play for opening day next Tuesday. JR, in the bigger picture of baseball and sports and broadcasting, where does Bob Uecker fit in?
I mean, right near the very top, of course. And I think in the state of Wisconsin, there is no greater icon in Wisconsin sports history. You know, he is synonymous. His voice is synonymous with summer, with Brewers. You know, this is his 54th year with, you know, broadcasting for the organization, which is unfathomable. I mean, he's been in baseball for almost 70 years when you go back to his playing days. 90 years old. I mean, just a gem. Goes without saying. Needs no introduction. And it is refreshing to hear that he's going to be on the mic for some of these games as well. And you know, it sounds like, you know, you read between the lines and what the Brewers released, and it sounds like he's probably going to cut back. He's been doing just home games, not traveling, and it sounds like probably even fewer of those games this year. But of course, you understand that a 90-year-old guy is going to need a little bit of a break. You know, when you see him around the park, it does not strike you that he is that old. He moves around like a person, and he's still got all the zingers, you know. He does not strike somebody as a nanogenarian. So
what's it like for you behind the scenes when the lights off and the microphones are down? What's it like to just be around Bob Uecker?
I mean, obviously there's a presence, and he's there for batting practice and hanging around, and everyone loves him. Everyone wants to talk to him. Players get their pictures with him, you know, understandably. He's He's the legend. So it's great that he's there. He does get a chance to talk to players all the time, and of course the manager before every game. So he's a guy who is still a shining light for this organization, and as long as he's here, I know Brewers fans are going to want to hear his voice when summer gets going in late March and early April.
There's just nothing like sitting outside on a Wisconsin summer night listening to Bob Uecker on the radio. I think it's just been part of my whole life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. All of ours.
Exactly. For that matter, going out to the ballpark this summer, as Melissa mentioned, what's in store for those who are making their way to American Family Field this year?
Well, there's a new big video board. The center field video board has been redone. It's bigger, and I'm sure that'll catch people's attention. There's also a new video board in the right field corner. So just more graphics in general, and more eye-catching stuff. You know, they've tried to make the stadium as obviously over the course of time as fan-friendly as possible, and those upgrades kind of fall in line with what you see around baseball, just bigger and better scoreboards everywhere. I think we have our update at jsonline.com on the food situation. Parking is going to be different this year. That is something to monitor for people who are used to just showing up with some cash and paying for parking.
No,
that's going to be different. There's going to be an app where you prepay for parking and then there's not going to be somebody to take your money. You just park, but you know, if you haven't entered your driver's, the license on your car, the license plate, then you could get in trouble for that. So keep on the lookout for that. Look up that information. We'll have a story. The Brewers will have all kinds of information. But that process is going to be a little bit different. So that's good to know. And the team is going to be different this year too. Like we mentioned, it's just going to be a different vibe going offense instead of pitching.
There's another aspect that Melissa mentioned there that I want to touch on, and that is the changes that have occurred in baseball over the last couple of years, where you could take an afternoon with a ball game. Now it's a couple hours and change with a ball game. And Melissa says she's relatively new to the sport. Are we seeing some fresh blood move into the baseball?
Well, the biggest change I would say occurred last year, where they instituted this pitch clock, and that has dramatically cut down on how much time these games are absorbing. You used to go to the ballpark and it might be 4 hours. It's not going to be 4 hours. A confession to you, I am going to be covering opening day for us for the Journal Sentinel. I'm going to a concert that evening at Pfizer Forum, and I know that I can pull that off. I know that it's going to be 3 hours of baseball and then I'm good to go. Now, obviously, there's some wiggle room. It's not guaranteed to be anything. It's baseball. It could go several extra innings, but I think I can pull that off because the game is reduced. It moves very quickly. It's a much better fan experience for someone like me with kids. It's nice to go to a game and know that I'm not going to be there till the wee hours of the morning. Mm-hmm. This game is moving quickly, and it's just the pitch clock has totally revamped the experience of baseball.
Hey, JR, go Brewers. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Absolutely, anytime.
J.R. Radcliffe, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with the Milwaukee Brewers opening their season this afternoon. First pitch, 12:40 our time, against the New York Mets, and their home opener next Tuesday afternoon. And that will be against the Minnesota Twins. And thanks again to J.R. for joining in. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
The following program is pre-recorded.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Hundreds of poets, musicians, and performance artists, they recently converged for a poetry marathon to benefit Woodland Pattern, the Milwaukee nonprofit for poetry and the arts. The organization is also a catalyst for the Milwaukee Youth Poet Laureate Program. It's a competitive process. You submit poems and a resume, read a poem in front of a judging panel in the finals. We caught up with the city's inaugural Youth Poet Laureate. That is Emily Igwike, whose tenure runs through the end of the year. She explains to WPR's Mackenzie Crummy why she applied to this program.
Well, I think the main thing that kind of attracted me to the program was not only the opportunity to integrate myself into the greater community of poets and artists within Milwaukee and get the opportunity to meet people in that space and also grow as a poet in that space, but also the emphasis that this program had on like civic leadership and community service.
And you consider poetry a way for people to look inward, from my understanding, and to create a sense of self. So can you tell us, what are you discovering about yourself when creating poetry?
With writing poetry, I think that I realized it's an excellent way to kind of encapsulate the moments that for me were very revealing about myself and my character, and also things I've begun to value more as I've grown up. For example, I feel like I've had more opportunities to just really enjoy times and spaces of silence and isolation. And although it sometimes seems daunting and overwhelming at first, but looking back on it, I feel like these moments of like quiet and like solitude were excellent ways for me to reflect on where I've come and how far I've come and progressed, but also maybe where I want to be and where I want to grow and where I want to continue to go.
So thinking of that writing process, I understand that you often base your poems on memories or events in your life, but at the same time, it can be kind of spontaneous. So can you give an example of a life event that may have triggered a poem for you?
Yes. So one of my favorite memories I've ever written a poem about was probably when I was able to share a meal with my mom. And in this memory, we're just simply sharing one of my favorite Nigerian dishes, which is ofe egusi, and the side of pounded yam. And we're just talking and we're just sharing this meal together. And in this memory, it was just kind of one of the best ways I could ever characterize like my mom's like endearing love for me. And then also just this warm, just homely conversation that we had over a plate of my favorite food. And this memory in particular just always reminds me of just like the power of just simply sharing a meal with someone that I love.
For students considering poetry as an outlet in their lives, how would you advise them to start?
I think to start writing poetry is to first get over this fear of the blank page and know that poetry doesn't have to look a certain way or sound a certain way to necessarily be good. I feel like once you approach poetry genuinely and sincerely and just know or use it as a place to put down your deepest thoughts or put down your deepest emotions, that it will be able to guide you itself, and that any first draft is simply that first draft. So no poem always comes out perfect when you first write it down. But if you're looking to poetry as an outlet, you should never be afraid to start or never be afraid of the blank page or be afraid, oh, what this sounds bad, because your personal emotions and your deepest sentiments about anything in your life are genuine and they deserve to be maybe honored or commemorated within a poem or just a place for you to have that safe space. I think anyone should have access to a safe space in their life, whether it is through writing, whether it is a physical space. So being just getting that courage to get over the intimidation of that blank page or that blank screen and just start writing is honestly the first way to start. And then knowing that as long as you're being genuine and as long as you're approaching it sincerely, that it's going to guide itself and it's going to be a beautiful poem if you just approach it that way.
That validation is so helpful. You have a poem to read for us.
Yes, this poem is titled Untitled. A few months ago, my youth spilled onto scuffed linoleum floors and I began tasting citrus. Sweet curiosity rotted too quickly and my thoughts blossomed, whispering that time passing is so sour. Or maybe a loosely wrapped gift, opened once, then discarded. Temporary joy trapped between flimsy calendars. Or maybe just the seconds flowing out of you into the sky and its pinpricks of patient stars. Last night, I remembered their bursts of radiant light are simply empty projections, flickering with what used to be full of life. Thank you.
That is Emily Igweke, Milwaukee's first youth poet laureate. She spoke with WPR's Mackenzie Crummy about the program and her experience writing poetry. Now we're back in conversation with a pair of Wisconsin-based poets, R.B. Simon in Madison, Antonio Vargas Nieto in Milwaukee. Antonio, you're a mentor to Emily Igweke through the Youth Poet Laureate program. What is the importance of a formal program for students in the city?
I think the main purpose it serves is to show students that there is reason to write poetry. There is an audience for poetry. There's a need for poetry. And they have an opportunity to express themselves in a way that elevates them, you know, beyond maybe just their journal or their friend circle or their classroom. It can take them, I mean, through the National Youth Poet Laureate Program, as a potential to elevate them to a national stage, which is a lofty goal, but not the main goal, I would say. The main goal is to show students that writing poetry is important, and we want to hear more of it.
Arby, what comes up for you as you heard Emily's poem?
First of all, it's a lovely poem, and it's always wonderful to hear youth writing such exquisite work. I work as a reader for the Harbor Review. I'm a senior poetry editor there. And we've gotten in some very young poets, and it's always very exciting to see sort of the next generation of poets start emerging. You know, there's rumors that poetry is dead, and we're trying very hard to prove that it is a vital and thriving and important part of our literary tradition. So it's very exciting for me.
What do you think Wisconsin could do better to support poet laureate programs and poets more generally?
You know, I think there's a lot of great offerings in Wisconsin for poetry. There's open mics everywhere. There's the Wisconsin Fellowship of Poets. There's the Wisconsin Writing Association. You know, there's ways to get involved, whatever level you want. I think the biggest barrier really is that people don't want to consider themselves poets. And I think that when we allow ourselves to just start recording our truths on paper, and those can be truths about our own lives or just observations about the world, and we allow ourselves to call ourselves poets and to hone our craft, a lot more people are going to engage in poetry. I just think it's become sort of an elite thing, and I want to bring it back down to public level.
Let's take a call now. Eileen and Sirona. Eileen, hi.
Hi, how are you, Joy?
Good. Well, go ahead.
My question is to Arvy and Antonio. I have been gathering a collection, which I'm going to put into an anthology, of more than 100 poems that my father wrote while he was alive. He is now deceased, and in going through these poems, there are many of them that have words that are not written down, or there's just a blank there. Like whoever typed this for him in the beginning didn't translate the word properly. It doesn't make sense. It's just totally missing. I'm a retired editor myself and writer, but I don't know how to handle this. Do I make a note in the beginning in the introduction and say some of the words are missing, or do I just completely delete the entire poem?
Or perhaps even, you know, fill in some missing words. Antonio, what thoughts come up for you?
I think that would be a really good way to explore sort of like found poetry in certain ways. I mean, I'm not, you know, going to tell you to take on the voice of your father, but maybe it could turn into a dialogue, or maybe, you know, you say you have an experience as an editor, maybe you can sort of coax out the intention of the poem and fill the word. I mean, that's where my mind is going.
Arby, how about you when there are missing words?
Yeah, I actually sort of love the potentiality of that situation, because you could do so many things with it. You certainly could fill in what you think is the best word and say, you know, I've done my best to complete this in the vein of my, you know, my father's wishes and intent. Or like Antonio said, you could really play with a dialogue with your father and explore, you know, those pieces that do have missing words. What would you put there? You could play even with format in terms of like, going back and forth between those dialogues of missing spaces and the original text. So there's a lot you could do with that. I wouldn't discard it. You've got some great material to work with. I would just be very clear, you know, when I've done blackout or exposure poetry and I've used other people's words, I've bracketed my own words or used some other mode of showing the dialogue.
Eileen, thank you so much for sharing. Thanks for that question. Susan now in St. Francis is with us. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. What a great discussion. I wanted to share, I was a artist in residence for years in Oklahoma with elementary children. And what I would tell them about writing is a couple things. One, it's not something to do. It's a place to go. And the other thing was that writing is like dance and editing is like math. You don't ever try to do them at the same time. And so I say you write in the morning and you do math in the afternoon.
Oh, RB, how does that sound to you?
That's very similar to something a poetry teacher of mine once said. She says there's bashers, and I'm trying to remember the name for the other person, but the bashers are kind of the people who bash out all the material and then go back and edit versus people who edit along the way. I've tried very hard in my own career to become more of a basher because I want to go back and fix the comma. And that does interrupt the flow of creativity. So I think if you can, bashing out that initial poem in a rough first draft is a great way to save some nuggets that you might already edit out if you aren't careful.
Antonio, what do you think of these nuggets that poetry is a place to go, not something you do?
I think that's really wonderful. I think that's a really good way to think about poetry, because oftentimes for me, it's an opportunity to reflect, to slow down, to instead of doing the 100 other things that are pulling for my attention, I think it's good to just sit down and make time for yourself and for poetry. And as far as like editing as you go, I'm so guilty of that in my years as a poet. What I find helps me is writing by hand. I'm a very visual thinker. So if I see all of my thoughts in front of me, that helps me organize them better. And I also find that I can track my drafts better if I'm handwriting them, because I'm like looking at the word, every word, every time I write it, as opposed to when I edit digitally, I lose track of previous drafts, so I can't really compare and contrast, or I'll just copy and paste over typos back and forth and like not really notice it. So that's something that I find that helps me is writing by hand. It also adds the like slowing down, adds to the slowing down aspect.
A pair of Wisconsin poets, Antonio Vargas Nieto and RB Simon, sharing their work, their inspiration, their tips for writing. You can join the conversation at any point. Email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Poetry, it offers fresh, surprising ways to hear language. We have a pair of Wisconsin poets explaining why poetry endures, and they help us see the world in new ways. You can join email ideas@wpr.org. Antonio Vargas Nieto is here, and RB Simon in Madison. Let's take another call now. Stefan in Racine. Stefan, hi.
Good morning. I hope you can hear me okay.
We can indeed.
Thank you. I'm a statewide poetry editor, and I've been involved in critiquing and doing workshops for about 40 years. One of the things that I find difficult to negotiate is the part of revision that gets newer poets to buy into the process. So someone will come to a group and say, well, I went to this open mic and I got lots of applause and they told me my poetry was great, so I don't want to make any changes. And I really believe that poetry needs poetics, and concrete language is better than, you know, abstract language. So I'm kind of old school that way. Any thoughts on getting folks to buy into the need to revision? Because I think we can make a great case that there are good poems and there are weak poems. And if you want to write a really good poem, then revision is a part of that process.
Stefan, thank you for that. Antonio, go ahead.
Well, I would say providing examples of where revisions could be done, and I guess like doing it in a gentle, suggestive way, or oftentimes asking about the intention of a word choice. When I'm working with high school students and I find that maybe I'm unclear on something, or the message is not, it doesn't have the impact that's intended, I'll just pose questions about their word choice, about maybe a word is repeated throughout, and I'll ask, is this like a rhythmic choice? Is this kind of an oversight? And I'll tell them, you know, like there's different times and places to use repetition. So if you use the same word multiple times, I feel that it loses impact because you're seeing the word, but maybe sometimes you want to like maybe diminish the power of a word, or you want to like lull the reader into thinking that they know what the word, and then you completely change how you use the word. So there's like a lot of ways to introduce revision in sort of like a creative, curious way, rather than, well, maybe think again, or like maybe think about your word. You know, there's ways to propose revision in a way that feels a little bit more maybe enticing or exciting.
RB, what are your thoughts about the process and approach to feedback?
I absolutely love to get feedback. I'm one of those people that loves external validation. So I very much appreciate it when people are willing to read and give me constructive criticism on my work. You know, I've had the pleasure of leading workshops and also participating in workshops for revising. And one of the best pieces of advice I've ever gotten is just to consider the world of the poem, again, by another poet who taught a class, but asking line by line in a poem, how does this line serve the poem? And if it doesn't really, is it necessary? Or could I just add one word to the sentence above it, or something like that? So I think efficiency in language is something else I aim for, and my poems aren't super long, but I like them to be concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
There, so that's where my vision process is, yeah.
There goes that hunt for that one specific word that you're looking for.
Right.
Oh, well, Stefan, thank you so much for joining in. Kenneth now in Beloit. Kenneth, hi.
Hi, when I was first taught about poetry, I was told that it's about putting your feelings on paper. And I'd like to comment on the lady that found her father's poetry was blank words. Well, we talked about how we struggle to find the word. And I think that was a form of art in that he left it for the reader to pick the word up.
Oh, Kenneth, thank you for that possibility. And we have less than a minute left. And I just want to leave it to you here. Antonio, what is your advice to poets who do want to publish their work?
I would say don't be afraid to self-publish. A lot of famous poets started by getting the work out there themselves. And don't be afraid to start small. You don't need to win the Pulitzer Prize or whatever with your first poetry collection.
And RB, your words of advice for the poet who wants to publish? Oh, RB, are you still there?
Yes, I am. Sorry, I said something, but you can hear me.
I couldn't hear.
I would just say be bold enough to consider yourself a poet and embrace that identity, and then just let yourself write.
Well, thank you both for joining us. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Antonio Vargas Nieto, Milwaukee writer and artist, also at Woodland Pattern in Milwaukee. R.B. Simon, poet, author, most recent book is called Not Just the Fire. And earlier, we heard from Milwaukee's inaugural Youth Poet Laureate, Emily Igwike. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and up ahead, we explore pocketbook tips on saving and building wealth for retirement with the creator of the financial advice website Millennial Money. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Madison business owner. It's part of a series we're airing this month on women in southern Wisconsin in partnership with Midwest Mujeres.
Shadera Kilfoy Flores of Madison says she's often felt like a caretaker.
Well, I'm a mom. I'm a community member of a number of different communities.
That includes working with young people in Madison.
There's a lot of mommying that I do behind closed doors, mostly to LGBTQ, Black and Brown youth who, for whatever reason, may not have supportive parents at home.
Plus, you can add artist, garden organizer, and chef to that resume. She told me about this as part of a storytelling partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. Kilfoy Flores has always been politically active, but there was one incident in Madison that changed everything for her.
Yeah, it's a hard one. My neighbor was killed by a police officer, and he wasn't just a neighbor. He was a family friend. He was a friend of my daughter's. He was a son of friends of mine.
That friend was Tony Robinson Jr., the 19-year-old shot and killed by a Madison police officer in 2015.
And it's been very, very hard to see the snowball of damage that his death has created.
Robinson's death sparked widespread demonstrations in the city. The Dane County District Attorney did not press charges against police officer Matt Kenny, who fatally shot Robinson. The family has worked for years to try to change that. Kilfoy Flores and her daughter, Serena Flores, channeled their grief by participating in the protests. Then, Serena got arrested at a demonstration outside her high school.
You know, she cried about the loss of freedom and that she had never felt so degraded and scared all at the same time. And I don't know that you ever heal from having your freedom taken away.
The charges against her daughter were later dropped. But this moment, paired with the shooting, made Kilfoy Flores want to do more. So she joined Madison's Police Civilian Oversight Board, the first of its kind in the state.
But the biggest difference is that Madison now has our very first independent police monitor.
The board works with that monitor and makes recommendations around police use of force and discipline. Kilfoy Flores is now the chair, and one of her goals is to create a safer community for civilians and officers.
I'm hoping that this can be a sustainable tool for accountability, but also for creating a bridge for community to be able to have more input in how we're being policed as well.
Kilfoy Flores has big goals. Once her time with the Police Oversight Board is up, she'd like to focus her attention on creating local, state, and federal legislation surrounding police accountability. And in the meantime, she hopes to encourage others to stand up for the issues they believe in.
Be the change that you want to see. If you see that something needs to happen, sometimes you got to make it happen yourself. We cannot always depend on others making the changes that we want. Sometimes you got to get off your duff and make it happen.
Shadera Kilfoy Flores told us her story as part of a partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. We've partnered with the organization to share stories of women who live in southern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent. And according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum's most recent numbers, the median home price in our state has increased by more than 50% over just 5 years. Experian Automotive says the average car payment has risen to almost $530 a month. Add to that higher interest rates, looming student loan repayments, and maybe some child care if you can't afford it, and it's not hard to understand why. Some semblance of financial security seems so unattainable, especially if you are a millennial between the ages of 28 and 43. So how do you begin building up that nest egg while still being able to afford the cost of living? Join our conversation this hour at 1-800-642-1234 with your experiences or questions for our guest. 800-642-1234. Emails available anytime. Ideas at WPR.org. Grant Sabatier is the creator of the financial advice website Millennial Money, a podcaster, author of the 2019 book Financial Freedom, A Proven Path to All the Money You Will Ever Need, and co-founder and CEO of BankBonus.com. Grant, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Glad to be back.
So in 2010, you've got just a handful of dollars to your name, literally handful of dollars in your bank account. By 5 years later, you're 30 years old and you've saved $1.25 million. Can you give us an idea of what those 5 years were like for you, Grant?
Yeah, it was certainly an intense period. My mid-20s to my early 30s, money was pretty much all I thought about. It was my singular goal. And this was all precipitated because when I was 24, I was completely broke and had to move back home with my parents. And so didn't want to stay there long. Had never really thought much about money before, but it was around this time that, you know, I put on my philosophy major hat and thought, you know, very strategically, what is money? Why is everyone so stressed about it? And most importantly, how can I go out and make more? So it was my sole focus during that 5 year period. I had a full-time job for 1 year and then I became an entrepreneur. And that entire period, I was saving about 82% of my income and investing it and living as frugally as I could.
More than 80% of what you made, you were able to sock away. That's an incredible amount of savings. Where did that savings come from? Where did you scrimp?
Pretty much everywhere. So, you know, I didn't have any kids yet. I wasn't married yet. And so I moved from a relatively expensive apartment. I had an $1,800 a month apartment, and I moved to an $800 a month apartment with a roommate. And then I needed a car, so I bought a $700 Nissan Maxima off of Craigslist, and it was the cheapest, most reliable car that I could find. And so when you reduce your housing expense and your transportation expense, really the biggest other category is food. And so I started cooking myself instead of eating out and started minimizing just the amount of time that I spent out, you know, going out with friends, or when I did go out, I just tried to not spend a lot of money. And so just reducing those three big categories to as little as possible, I was able to sock away a lot of extra money, especially with it being my focus.
Yeah, Grant, while I was learning about your story, I was curious. I wanted to know from you, like, what did you drink for 5 years? Was it just water?
Oh, no. I mean, this is the thing. A lot of people think that I just lived in a cardboard box.
Right.
But when you're really mindful about, you know, your spending and your relationship to money, and for me, I started to recognize that every dollar that I was saving and investing would be worth upwards of $10 or $20, you know, down the road in the future. And so I started viewing saving really as an opportunity instead of a sacrifice. And I lived like normal people. You know, I had, you know, glasses of wine, and I didn't drink soda, but, you know, pretty much coffee, wine, and water, you know, kept me going.
When you look back at those years, socking away more than 80% of what you were making, is there anything you look back on now and say, I wish I had done this a little bit differently?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm certainly an extreme example. And this is, you know, I cover a lot of this in the book. I'm really an outlier where, you know, I spent 98% of my, you know, waking hours and mental thought process trying to learn everything that I could about money, and, you know, realized that a lot of it out there was, you know, either a scam or designed to kind of take your money. And so once I reframed my relationship, the biggest challenge was choosing to live my life differently than my friends and the people around me. So I remember picking my mom up at Chicago O'Hare Airport, and she made fun of my car the entire way driving downtown. And my girlfriend, who's now my wife, also, you know, made fun of some of my, you know, frugality habits. And so the most challenging thing was just living a little bit differently than everyone else. I do think I was a little bit intense, and looking back on it, I probably could have, you know, laid off the gas pedal a little bit and still reached financial independence in 7 to 10 years. But, you know, I was happy while I was doing it, and, you know, seeing my net worth grow, seeing the amount of freedom that I had, the more options that I was acquiring, you know, that really motivated me, and it made me feel kind of unique. And it's always nice to kind of go against the grain and the status quo and figure something out that previously I thought I couldn't figure out. And, you know, a lot of my friends and my parents and everyone around me was stressed about money. And I started to, once I'd saved and invested, started to be less and less stressed about money. And that really freed me up to think about other things and also invest my time in other ways.
What are the economic conditions today that you see, Grant, that would encourage people to work towards an early retirement?
Yeah, so we're certainly living in a much more difficult climate than when I started my financial independence journey in 2010. But on the flip side, I think it's really never been easier to make money on your own terms. There's so many different ways. You know, when I started side hustling, you know, there wasn't Uber. You couldn't, you know, work for and deliver for Instacart. You couldn't create digital products online. You know, it was a much more restricted environment. And so I'm very bullish, actually, on people's ability to make money. And just in the position that I'm in, I get so much outreach from people really all over the world who are just finding creative ways to become entrepreneurs, start side businesses, and really increase that other side of the coin. I mean, you can really only cut back so much, but, you know, your income, there's a lot of ways to make additional money now. And if you use that money and invest it as opposed to just spending it, you know, I'm still very bullish on the American economy, the American investor, and entrepreneurs generally.
Right now on your website, you have 23 plus best money-making apps of 2024. You're telling me I can make money just through an app?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's so many ways that, I mean, you can make money doing anything. You can review Amazon products. You can, one of the biggest things right now is just being, you know, a freelance editor. Because of the digital economy, there's just so much demand for being a proofreader, being a freelance editor, if you're detail-oriented. I mean, there are people, you know, moms, people who have no experience in this, but, you know, they're detail oriented and, you know, they're able to make $20, $30 an hour.
Whoa.
Just on their free time, you know, with some of these side businesses. So it's the digital economy has really opened all of this up, and it requires so many supporting roles. I know people who have no bookkeeping experience and they're able to, within a year, launch a bookkeeping business, you know, making $5,000 a month and what? Then able to grow that business. And so there's just a ton of demand for these really kind of digital economy support services that didn't exist before.
Yeah, and that's not indifferent to your story, Grant, where it took, I mean, what you started out with knowing very little about Google Ads and the a digital ad universe, and through YouTube, you were able to train yourself into becoming what you are today, a financial advice website, millennial money podcaster, and author of Financial Freedom, a proven path to all the money you will ever need. Grant Sabatier, our guest. We're taking a look at how to get ahead financially and what you need to do to save and what you need to do to earn and what you can do to invest. And we'd take your questions and comments along the way at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're looking at ways to save money, opportunities for making money, and the best investments you can make to create some financial security for your family, especially if you're a millennial between the ages of 28 and 43. Grant Sabatier is the creator of the financial advice website Millennial Money, a podcaster, and his book, Financial Freedom, A Proven Path to All the Money You Will Ever Need. And you're invited to our conversation, 1-800-642-1234. Your questions and comments are welcome here at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. So, Grant, these side hustles, the best money-making apps you have on your website right now and your suggestions, you see these gig economy jobs outside of apps, for example, Uber or DoorDash. Do you support these? Are these part of our financial security?
Well, they're certainly good places to start. Okay. So it can be difficult to just jump into full-time entrepreneurship. But any time that you're trading your time for money, you're going to be limited by the amount of money that you can make. So we see this in a lot of markets. Uber is a great place to make, you know, $500 to $1,000 in additional income, but you're only making money when you're out there in your car driving. And so it's a good place to start making a little additional money, but I typically recommend that you invest your time and build your skills to create a side hustle where you don't have to trade your time for money. So a good example is if you want to be a dog walker, you know, you can create a little dog walking business, create, you know, walk dogs in your neighborhood. But over time, what you really want to do is be the connector between supply and demand. So you don't want to be the driver for Uber. You want to be Uber, because Uber doesn't own any of the cars. They connect people who need rides with people who want to give rides. And you can do the same thing pretty much in any industry. And the dog walking example, if you create your own dog walking business and you hire people to do the dog walks, and then you're just connecting people who need dog walkers with people who are willing to walk dogs, that's where you really unlock the income potential. You know, you become basically a business owner as opposed to someone just trading your time for money. So I always encourage people, learn the skill set, just like I did. You know, I learned how to build websites from YouTube. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to learn these skills, especially digital economy skills, and then start offering them, get some clients, get some good testimonials, and then focus all of your energy on going out and trying to get more clients and finding someone to deliver the services, because that's really where you build a business, and that's really how businesses work.
If you go to our guest website right now, millennialmoney.com, you will find a simple truth, as it says, money is infinite, but time is not. Rather interesting take on financial advice and building a financial nest egg, Grant.
Yeah, I mean, this was the huge revelation for me when I was 24, that any time that you're working and getting paid for that, you're trading your time, which you can't get back, for money, which you can always go out and make more of. And so once I started thinking about that, it really changed my mindset. And I thought, okay, how can I go out and make as much money as I can for my time, and then really try to protect my time as much as possible? Because at the end of the day, we only have so much time. And so a good example, if you're, you know, making money, if you invest that money, then that money that you've invested starts making money for you, and you didn't have to trade any of that time for the money that your 401k made for you, for example. And so across all areas of your financial life, if you can maximize the amount of money that you're making without having to trade your time, whether it's through investing, whether it's through having a business, ultimately that gets you a lot more freedom. And every dollar that you invest is actually future freedom. It's not just money, because in the future, it's going to be bigger and you're just going to have more options than you did today.
We're talking about saving and investing for early retirement with Grant Sabatier, founder and owner of the personal finance website Millennial Money, where money is infinite, but time is not. We go to your questions and comments next at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jack and Madison, good morning.
Hey, good morning. How's it going?
Good.
Yeah, so I was just thinking, I wonder what Grant's thoughts were on financial independence, retire early, aka FIRE, because it seems like a lot of what he's doing ties into that. And I've been trying to follow the FIRE philosophy myself, saving, you know, 60 to 80% of my income, investing in index funds and doing other things like that to get ahead in the economy. You know, as much as I'd like to start my own business or whatnot, you know, even a side hustle like this, but I was just curious to see what he thought of FIRE and how that ties into his thinking and his approach to money and getting ahead in the economy like this.
Jack, before I turn to Grant here, I want to ask you, do you feel the pinch when it comes to saving as much as 60 to 80% of your income? Does it hurt your lifestyle? Have you been able to accommodate it? What's it feel like?
I'm really glad you raised the question. You know, I feel like it's not that much of a pinch. I mean, there are moments when I wish I could go out to eat a little more, or I could do other fun things. You know, I try to be fun with stuff on the site. You know, I love going to concerts. And right. So, right. You know, maybe once a month or so I'll go to a concert, but I try not to push it that much. So.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Jack. And Grant, we've got about a minute before the news, but we'll continue on this conversation about the FIRE movement, because as I understand it, as Jack mentioned, you are a proponent of this this FIRE movement, which stands for?
Financial independence, retire early.
You all for it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this really was pretty pivotal to my own journey. Vicki Robin, who really is the godmother of the FIRE movement, wrote the foreword to my book. She's a dear friend of mine. And, you know, I agree with Jack that, you know, it really doesn't feel like a sacrifice as long as you've built a mindful relationship with money. And that's something that you're focused on. And so, like anything in life, you should be spending money to maximize your happiness per dollar. So spend money on those things that bring you joy, and the other stuff just save for future freedoms and the you that you've yet to become. So, huge believer in it. It's really a choose your own adventure. I think it gets misportrayed in the media as being all about deprivation and sacrifice. But at the end of the day, it's really about building a life that you love. And we can control so little in our life, but our relationship to money and what we do with it and the freedom that it acquires for us really is one thing that we can control. And so I'm all about the FIRE movement and choosing your own path in life.
Financial independence, retire early. Grant Sabatier, creator of the financial advice website Millennial Money, a podcaster and author of Financial Freedom, continues our conversation. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about challenges millennials face in building a financial safety net, while also pursuing the best paths towards saving more, making more, and investing more. We welcome you to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, and we'll get back to your calls in a moment. Our guest, Grant Sabatier, the creator of the financial advice website Millennial Money, podcaster and author of Financial Freedom, A Proven Path to All the Money You Will Ever Need. And Grant, when it comes to millennials, how do they begin setting a goal for how much money they'll need before they even go about attaining it? How do you figure out that number?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because it's incredibly difficult for humans to predict the future, and especially how much money we're going to need in the future. But the best place to start is based on how much money that you're spending today. So typically it's recommended that you save, you know, 3 to 6 months of your current expenses in a high yield savings account. That's your emergency fund that you can get to anytime if you have an emergency. After you've done that, you should be investing really for the long term, which is 5, 10, 20 plus years. And that should be in tax-advantaged accounts like 401ks and IRAs. And really, you should try to invest early, often, and as much as you can, because so much of investing is about time in the market as opposed to timing the market. So right now, the stock market is at an all-time high as we record this. But really, if you zoom out and really fast forward to 20 years from now, it's going to be comparatively very low. And so you should really try to invest as much as you can. And then along the way, get more specific about how much money do you actually need. It doesn't take that much time, but maybe the next 90 days, look at the money that you're spending, go through your credit card statement, look at everything you bought, and just ask yourself, you know, was this worth it? Did this bring me the amount of happiness that I thought it would? And over time, just asking simple questions like that, you're going to recognize that you're spending money on the things that make your life better and then cutting back on the things that don't make your life better. And then just try to save as much as you can. And as you get closer to retirement, as your money grows, you know, continue to revisit those types of questions, because who you are today is going to be very, very different than who you're going to be 5, 10, 20 years from now. And so the financial industry always tries to sell you on a level of precision that's unrealistic, because we don't know who we're going to be in the future.
So you've sort of taken a common investment, buy low, sell high, and changed that to buy now and sell much, much, much later.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, really, it's about getting your money to work for you as long as possible. And, you know, so much of the traditional advice, you know, especially that my parents got and that's still pretty popular today is, you know, save 5 to 10% of your income. But that's just really a simple math problem. And when the average person saves 5 to 10% of their income, they're either never going to be able to retire because their money's not going to grow enough, or they're just going to have a lot less than they really need. And so if you can save 10 to 20%, 20 to 30%, just adding a little bit extra significantly reduces the amount of time that you actually have to work in the future.
Grant Sabatier, our guest, website Millennial Money, and your questions and comments now at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eugene in Viola, good morning.
Good morning. I live on about $15,000 in a year's time.
Whoa. How?
I get by just fine, and I save money. Last fall, I spent 2 weeks in Hawaii. By the time I got done, including my plane ticket, I spent about $1,200.
You should be a guest.
I bought a Ford pickup, a Ford Ranger, from a private party. The bank put up, I put up $500. The bank put up $4,500. My payments come out to $150 a month. I pay $220. Then I got to saving pennies, copper pennies. Those are worth 2 to 3 cents a piece, pretty much. And I take envelopes. And I put money into those envelopes, what I've got to pay each month. I keep track of what I spend. And I raise my own garden. I get along just fine. And I've generally got money to spend when I want it.
Wow. Hey, Eugene, you sound like you were one of the original of the FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early. Are you still, what do you do for income these days?
Well, during the summer months, I run that shoe. I'll be going back on the road again this summer with that shoe shine stand, and I'm 85 years old.
Wow, so a long way from being a millennial. Where can we find Eugene's shoe shine stand this summer?
I will be, my first event, I will be in Nakusa in June for an old-fashioned day. One summer I did 12 or 13 events, and I took in just about $2,000, and I only charged $3 or $4 for a shoe shine. Charge $4, and most of the time you'll get $5.
Eugene will be looking for you this summer, and thanks for sharing your financial story with us this morning. Grant, it makes me think of how when you tell the story of your 5 years to financial independence and how you got to 30 with over $1 million in your bank account but started with really literally next to nothing, you talk about how that first year is the only year you actually had a job while you were building up that money, or at least you were working for wages with a full-time employment. How important is entrepreneurship to the big picture of financial independence, especially the younger you are?
It's certainly not essential, but
okay.
Whenever you can be your own boss and control the money that you're making, you're likely always going to be able to make more. I mean, we see this today. A lot of people think that W-2 jobs are less risky than entrepreneurship, but you know, just look over the past, 6 to 12 months, there's been over 300,000 layoffs at these companies that people never thought they'd be laid off from. You know, the Amazon, the Googles, the Metas of the world. And I think what you're seeing with certainly the growth of AI and just the rapid changes in our economy, if you're doing a physical type job, right, it's like you can't replace a daycare worker with a robot. But if you're in the knowledge economy, I think there's a lot of worry. And full-time jobs are not nearly as secure, most W-2 jobs, as they have been. And so entrepreneurship, on the flip side, most studies show that entrepreneurs are actually a lot happier than full-time workers, even though there's a little bit of stress in managing your own income. Just your ability to control your own time, your own future, your own potential tends to make entrepreneurs happier. And so for me, I had the W-2 job saved as much as I could, but realized there was really a limit just because I could negotiate for raises, but my salary was really capped based on what my employer was willing to pay me. And so once I went out and started, building my own businesses, obviously there was no limit to that. And I just had a lot more money to save and a lot more control of my time and really a lot more control of my destiny.
So do you see a path to be able to work your way to financial independence and just go along with the 401k that is part of your benefits package? Is if you just go that route and that route alone, is there a path to financial independence these days?
Oh yeah, 100%.
Okay.
So it's still certainly possible. There's just a limit to, certainly how much you can save and how much you can cut back. So yeah, I hear from teachers all the time who are retiring in their, mid to late 40s, and they've been saving diligently for the past 20 years. What really matters is the next 5 years of your financial life. And so what you want to do is the next 5 years, if you can cut back, if you can make more money, if you can, increase the amount that you're investing, the benefit of the next 5 years, no matter how much money you're making, really is going to set you up for the future. And so this isn't something like you have to do for next 10 or 20 years. What you do in the interim really matters the most.
Eugene also brought up another aspect that is part of your Millennial Money website, and that is what is to do in times of need. When you need to borrow some money, it sounded like Eugene got a great deal with his bank and his pickup truck. But if I'm a millennial and I'm looking to save as much as I can, but I need to borrow something to get by, what am I looking for, Grant?
Yeah, I mean, this is an absolutely terrible time to borrow money for anything. Mm-hmm. And so that's the real challenge here, is that housing has never been more expensive. Interest rates haven't been this high in so long, which makes buying a new car a lot more expensive. And so what you want to do is really try to minimize those large purchases right now. It's actually a really terrible time to buy a house. It's across the country, on average, about 38% cheaper just to rent. And so keep renting. Don't take out that loan. I would try to minimize the amount of debt that you take on today as much as possible, and wait ultimately for interest rates to come down and make those larger purchases. So I don't recommend taking a loan for anything. If you have to, you know, I liked the advice just going to really your local bank. You know, we often think that, you know, it's going to the large banks is going to get us the best deal. But right now, credit unions are where it's at. So credit unions have been growing, you know, pretty rapidly in terms of their membership. And if you stay in your local community, they're often willing to invest in your local community. So go to your local credit union, your local or regional bank, talk to them about what you need to, you know, get a car loan or a mortgage, as opposed to going to, you know, some of the bigger players in the market.
What about the money I already borrowed? For millennials making their way out of a college education, many of them find themselves burdened with a debt that their wages aren't going to cover in the near future. What about the money that you've already borrowed and already take with you when you start this financial trip?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this really comes down to just a simple math problem, which is you should be paying off your highest interest debt first. Mm-hmm. So if you have credit card interest debt, you know, typically the APR is going to be, you know, 25 to 30%. You want to pay that down because that's really like getting a guaranteed return. If you have student loans, any student loan rate below 5%, you know, just you can pay the minimum payment and just you should be investing your extra money. But anything above that, you should be trying to pay off. And so always pay off your high interest debt first. And then, you know, student loans obviously is a big topic now. If you have student loans, a lot of people are paying a higher interest rate than they need to. And there are easy ways you can go and get competitive offers to refinance or consolidate your student loan debt and significantly reduce the interest rate and or the payment that you have to make. So just being smart about how you're managing your debt and then making sure that you're tackling your first debt or your largest interest rate debt first is a savvy strategy. And then also not delaying investing. So I see this far too often that people have student loans and they just pay them off and that's what their focus is. You have to be investing while you're paying off your student loans, because it's the investing ultimately that really is more important than paying off your student loans, because that investing is the money that's going to compound and grow well into the future and give you significantly more options than just paying down your debt. So you should always be investing in addition to paying off your student loans.
Just to be clear here, if my interest rate for my student loan were greater than my expectations of a rate of return on my investments, you'd still recommend putting money in investments while doing a part at least to pay down those student loans?
Specifically in your tax advantaged accounts like your 401k. And so your 401k is a perfect example where if your employer matches your contribution, you should always be contributing enough to get that, because it's basically like getting completely free money. And you should be doing that before you're paying off your student loans, because that's free money that you're going to get that you wouldn't get otherwise. And then the tax advantages, because when you contribute to a Roth IRA or a 401k, it reduces your taxable income. And so the net benefit of that, even though your student loan interest rate is high, ends up being significantly greater, because you've invested more money that can compound without having to pay tax up front. You only pay when you withdraw in the future. So you should definitely be investing in tax advantaged accounts like 401ks and IRAs, in addition to paying off your student loan debt, even if your student loan debt is high, because the tax advantages and the free contributions statistically are worth it.
a viable path towards financial security, especially for millennials who are between the ages of 28 and 43. What about Gen Z coming up, who would be the ages between 12 and 27? Grant Sabatier is the creator of the financial advice website Millennial Money, podcaster and author of Financial Freedom, a proven path to all the money you will ever need. And there's still time for your questions and comments about how you were able to get ahead, or your financial security or insecurity for that matter. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Money is infinite, but time is not. That kernel of wisdom comes from our guest website, millennialmoney.com. Grant Sabatier spent the hour talking about his experiences in finding his way to financial independence and helping build a path for the rest of us to find our way towards some sort of financial security. And we've still got time for you this morning at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tim in Wausau, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us your story.
I've got a question here for your guest, more of a question. I'm 60 years old. I've managed to sneak away a fair amount of money. And I'm also maxing out my 401k and with the catch-up amount over 55 and stuff. But I do not have any tax deductions whatsoever available to me to reduce my taxable income. And my question is, you know, strategies such as creating an LLC or something, what can a person like myself do to be able to take better advantage of the money that I do have and reduce my taxes?
Yeah, it's a great question. I appreciate it, Tim. Grant?
Yeah, it's a great question. So if you're making any money outside of your full-time job, then it can make sense to start an LLC. An LLC, you know, gives you a vast number of legal protections, but one of the most important things that it gives you access to is the ability to open what's known as a SEP IRA, which is an employment retirement plan for basically entrepreneurs and business owners. And so if you have a business on the side, you can sock away a fair amount of additional income in a SEP IRA, and that is a tax advantage account. So that reduces your taxable income as well. And so, you know, there are certain limits to that that you have to look up. It's about 25% you can sock away into that. And so it only makes sense to have an LLC if you have a side business. But this is one of the myriad advantages of having a side business, is that you can not only sock away more money, but because you have your side business, you can also take expense deductions for anything related to your side businesses. So if you have a home office, you can deduct a portion of that. If you're traveling for that business, you can deduct a portion of that. And coincidentally, you know, you have to keep good records, but just having a side business ends up helping you, you know, not only make more money, but also reduce your taxable income.
Nice. Where would I go to find the avenues for entrepreneurship and the opportunities to build on a growing industry?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I write a lot about this in my book, Financial Freedom, which, you know, going back to your, you know, thoughts on the FIRE movement, is entirely a playbook to reach financial independence. And so really the sum is greater than the parts, in that I focus on how to cut back, how to make more money, how to become an entrepreneur, how to find a side business idea, how to grow it, and then what to do with that additional money. And so it is a step-by-step plan. So I recommend checking out my book, Financial Freedom. It's now in 15 languages. It's been quite successful. And in addition to that, the important thing really I recommend is just starting with YouTube. And so that's really where I started. And it's funny because I was really part of the first generation. You know, I turned 40 this year, and I'm like 200 years in internet years, but I did get to take advantage of being really early on the YouTube train and learning a ton. And I still use YouTube a lot. And so it's a really underutilized resource. It's a growing resource, but certainly an underutilized resource for, you know, people over 40. Millennials kind of get it. Gen Z definitely gets it. But if you want to learn anything, that's a really great place to start. And there are just so many people sharing their blueprints for how they're making money. And you can literally go in and learn about the economics for how to launch any type of business. And so it's far more valuable in a lot of cases than going out and spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on an MBA. I've never taken a business class. Everything I've learned about money and business, I've read in books from other people, listening to podcasts and watching YouTube videos.
And you can too, seems to be the end of that too.
Yeah, it's all free. I mean, we live in such an incredible time where, I mean, the quality of life that we have access to, you know, Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos, everyone says this, you know, the quality of life that even the average American has access to now is far superior than someone, you know, 100 years ago, John D. Rockefeller had. You know, we have all these advantages, all these creature comforts, and the same thing with information, just the availability, going to the library, you know, you can get my book out for free. You can just, just pour over just incredible resources. People who have been successful, you know, they're sharing how they're doing it. And that's incredible because, you know, the barrier to entry is pretty much nothing. As long as you're curious and you, you know, want to learn, the information is out there and people are taking advantage of it. And so there's really kind of no excuse to start if you, you know, are inspired to find additional ways to make money. It's really never been easier in history, and I think that's going to continue, you know, for quite some time.
Grant Sabatia, you said you're turning 40 or turned 40 or one on the older side of the millennial generation. You also have a young child now, and has parenthood changed your financial planning and the way you see your relationship with money?
Oh, absolutely.
How
so? I turned 40 in December of this year, so I'm almost there. but yeah, I feel very grateful that I was financially independent before I had a child, because it's very, you know, children are expensive. You know, daycare is expensive. I'm seeing that cost, you know, for me and my friends, you know, that's gone way up. And not only, you know, the cost of raising a child, but just the time that it takes, you know, as well. And so it takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of time. And so for me, that's really why I encourage people, before you have kids, have a firm financial foundation, so you're not going to be stressed, and that you can, you know, take time off from your job or just have more flexibility. And, you know, once again, you know, I know I sound like an entrepreneur evangelist here, but once again, another benefit of being an entrepreneur is that you can, you know, build your business around your life instead of, you know, having to build your life around your business. And you can engineer in, you know, I'm taking every, you know, Tuesday off to take my daughter to school. I'm going to attend these sporting events. And so it's really cool because we live in a time now, especially, you know, with remote work, mm-hmm. where we can spend more time with our kids. And, you know, it's just been a pure joy. And I feel, you know, very grateful that I do have the flexibility and the ability to spend time with her.
We've got about a minute left. But what about when your financial plan gets thrown a curveball, Grant? What do you do then?
Yeah, I mean, we know the only constant in life is change. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, being adaptable, being able to pivot is always a lot easier when you have money in the bank. And so save now while the times are good, while things are going well, and then you'll be much more amenable and have many more options if life does throw you a curveball. If you don't have a lot of resources and life is throwing you a curveball, you know, it's just a perfect time, you know, ultimately to reflect on, am I in the career that I want to be in? Am I still enjoying my job? You know, unfortunately, most people don't like their full-time jobs. But, you know, once again, there's so many opportunities available. And most people spend, you know, less time managing their money and managing their career than they do planning, you know, for their annual vacation. And so if you just spend a little bit of effort on this sort of stuff, you know, it really, really compounds and adds up over time. And you can shift industries, you can shift jobs, you can learn new skills. It really is just an incredible time to be alive. And I encourage you to prepare for the increasingly uncertain future by investing, saving as much as you can.
Money is infinite, but time is not. Grant Sabatier, we thank you so much for your time this morning.
Yep, glad to be on here. Thank you.
Founder of MillennialMoney.com, the 2019 book, Financial Freedom, A Proven Path to All the Money You Will Ever Need. Also, co-founder and CEO of BankBonus.com. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.